ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, Dying Time is here. That's right! It's Friday the 13th, Part 7, The New Blood, on Kill by Kill. Well, greetings and salutations, Internet. It's your old pal, Patrick Hamilton, coming to you once again from Camp Crystal Lake, or what used to be Forest Green, or just the recent, residential neighborhood development that we decided to plop on top of that old Camp Blood that no one was using anyways. And this is the Kill by Kill podcast, where we are dedicated to celebrating the least discussed component of any horror film, the characters. We are going to be unpacking all the gory details of Friday the 13th, Part 7, The New Blood, in the hopes that a partier's untimely end is just the beginning of the jokes that we can make about them. And as always, the only person that I trust to help me with my telekinesis-related psychological problems is the one and only Bad News, Gina Radcliffe. How you doing, Gina?
Well, I am stuck in the special kind of hell that is a New York City summer. It's about 96 degrees here with a humidity index of roughly 492. I would really like to be in this phantom Arctic zone that these people in these movies are constantly trapped in New Jersey, in this, where it's always cold in the summertime.
Yeah, it's a weird microclimate where everyone really does need a sweater at night.
Yeah, it sounds really refreshing to me right now, honestly, to be shivering outside a tent, even though I'm wearing tiny little shorts and complaining about how, and then immediately stripping down after complaining about how cold I am.
Yeah, we're going to get to that campers duo and try to figure out what's doing there. It's a very interesting scenario. But first, the good news is, we are not alone. Our special guest this week, you may know him from film Twitter. He's a bit of a podcasting leader and certainly someone we look up to here as the host of the F This Movie podcast, the one and only Patrick Bromley. Hello, sir.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me.
Oh, thank you so much for being here. Thank you so much for gracing us with your presence. We love F This Movie here.
Well, you are very nice to say that. I don't know that I can agree with it, but I'm a fan of this show. I think the concept is ingenious, and I really enjoy listening to it, so I'm excited to be part of it.
I did, when you said, oh, I'm listening right now, and I think you were listening to our Part 5 episode.
Yeah, I was.
I felt the way like I had just woken up from a dream where I was asked to take a test in high school and I wasn't wearing any clothes.
Football practice.
please, no one look at me. I don't know what chemistry is. My name am. I just suddenly got very paranoid. Like, we did good podcasts then, right? 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 Someone tell me. I immediately listened to our intro episode to that with John Brandon, which if you haven't heard that one, is pretty wild and woolly. And I think a good indicator of just how insane Part 5 would make us.
I will admit I'm a much bigger Part 5 fan than either of you, but it was very entertaining to listen to.
Just listening to the rage just destroying us and breaking us down and reforming us anew.
It's like listening to two people go crazy in real time, which is kind of neat.
Just when we thought we were out, we got pulled back into Part 5. We reference it fun. Now, people should like what they like. I don't blame people for enjoying Part 5 because I can see the what the fuck element to it.
Right.
But I have one question that I ask anyone who states a preference for Part 5, whether it's above all else or just in general. Where does that movie take place, do you think?
Like, where on Earth?
Yes. If on Earth is one of the options.
I think that might be the secret, is that it takes place in a weird side dimension. I just assume it's also in New Jersey.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I mean, I've never honestly given it that much thought in terms of its location.
Neither had I. I had always assumed that at some point in that movie, it tells you where it takes place. And it was only when we started watching it week after week after week while taking notes that we came to the realization that
it never bothers to tell the audience where in the world its particular insane Carmen Sandiego happens to be as far as a location. It's just...
Yeah, it's a little New Jersey. It's a little California. It's a little, obviously, where hillbillies dwell, as in right. Mama and Junior. It's kind of... Yeah, I would say that a sort of alternate dimension would make more sense.
It's a land of great chests, both male and female. Everyone's got a great chest, and they're not afraid to show it.
That is true. And it is where talking to oneself is not just ignored, but encouraged.
Encouraged by only yourself, because people rarely talk to one another.
And allowing cats to hang out in eating establishments. Very, very lax health codes there.
They're always sliding off of giant tubes or being shot out of cannons. The cats will come from anywhere in that joint.
We'll just call it Germ Newsy. How about that?
I love it.
That sounds about right.
Patrick, what was your first experience with the Friday the 13th franchise?
Honestly, my earliest memory of it can't be correct, because the first time I can recall watching one of these movies is like at a sleepover at a friend's house watching part 6, and that just seems way too late in the evolution of the series for me to finally be checking it out. So it's extremely possible that I had seen parts of previous installments prior to that, but the first full movie that I remember sitting through was part 6, and I remember thinking, oh well, that wasn't that gross. Because I think in my head it was built up that these movies were super gory, and by part 6, you know, they were moving away from that. And so I think I remember being surprised by the lack of graphic violence.
Yes. And I think that is something that struck us while we were watching part 6, was that there was a lot of that the magic tricks had to evolve to take away impact of a lot of things.
Right.
Like, they had obviously really gotten stung in part 5, where they just had to yank every bit of gore out of that for whatever reason. I assume MPAA involvement. And so you're left with a lot of now you see it, now you don't kind of goof them up tricks. Some of which are very effective and are more impactful than they would be if they contained gore. And then sometimes you're kind of like, really? Okay. sure. All right. At least I like these people.
Right. Well, yeah, Tom McLaughlin is just a better director. And so he realized, oh, okay, well, I'm not interested in just making a geek show. And if I'm not going to do that, then I need to figure out other ways to make this movie interesting. So I'll have sympathetic characters or clever dialogue or a sense of humor, whereas, you know, Danny Steinman was just like, more boobs, more blood, and then they had that cut up. So Tom McLaughlin knew how to compensate for those things.
Absolutely. And so this brings us now to part 7. Now we've evolved from the monster movie that part 6 is into this odd genre mashup, where we're getting a snobs versus slobs comedy smashed into Carrie, smashed into a Friday the 13th movie. And let us review at this moment in time who is still left alive. Let's do a quick body count.
All of them. All of them. Every character in every movie ever is alive in this movie.
There are less active participants in an NFL team than there are people in this movie at this moment in time.
I've never said this about any Friday the 13th movie up to this point. I feel like they're not killing people fast enough. Because there is a surplus of characters in this movie. And they're all pretty interchangeable. It doesn't help that they all are wearing the JCPenney Sport Pastels collection. And... I don't know any of their names. I did not figure out who the people we're going to be talking about's names were until almost up to the point where they were... No, a couple of them I had to look up because a couple of them didn't have any names, or at least their names weren't mentioned.
People don't say each other's names all that often. Ben's girlfriend, I had to deduce by looking up every actress's name and then going, no, she's the redhead. No, that's the other one. No. Oh, Kate, finally, it took me 15 minutes to find out who this person was.
There's a lot of players on the field. This is kind of feeling like a little bit like an episode of Game of Thrones, where you're just counting down people just to, you know, be knocked over like bowling pins.
Let's help everybody by giving them a description of them without the help of pictures. That's what a podcast is. It's audio. All right, so let's start, of course, with the star of the show. That's Tina. She's a teen psychic who you'll know is using her paranormal powers when you see her squint like she's trying to hold into fart inside of a car that's way too small and the windows don't roll down. There's a lot of effort involved in moving things mentally. And okay, that's fine. It works for me. The other thing that I noticed about Tina, and maybe this is just a Lar Park Lincoln thing, is that she talks as if her braces were just taken off camera. Her lips separate from her mouth a lot in her enunciation. It's not a bad thing. It's just the thing I noticed. So connected to Tina, of course, is Tina's mom, Mrs. Shepherd, who modeled her hair exclusively after viewing the Sphinx. And that style has become a total riddle to me. And then there's the medical help, of course, on site, and that's Dr. Bad News Cruz, played by the one and only Terry Kaiser.
Who's just an inexplicable ball of anger and rage at this teenage girl who could probably kill him with her mind at this point.
Yeah, his plan is mystifying to me.
He took that spike that she found, right? Isn't that a reveal later in the movie that he actually took it and is hiding it from her?
Right. To make her feel like she's crazy so that she will act out, so that she will use her telekinesis powers, but he doesn't ever seem to think that will come back to burn him. He's never experienced storytelling anywhere else. He's like, this will never touch me. I'll just make this crazy person who can't control her telekinetic powers mad.
You would think that like the Psychiatrist Association would have totally talked about what happened to John Cassavetes at the end of The Fury.
And what is his end game? If she does reveal her psychic powers and use them, what is his end game then?
I assume $$$$ is the only thing I can think of.
I mean, you would think so, but you would also hope that would be spelled out in some way that, you know, he would just write in his diary, can't wait to make money off psychic girl or something, so that we understand why he's so interested in her demonstrating these abilities.
Yeah, it's somewhere in between join Amway, force Tina to demonstrate telekinetic powers, make money. It's somewhere in that pyramid scheme. This is all going to go his way and everything's going to come up Milhouse for him. But as far as a business plan, he joins a long list of people who have very bad business plans in Crystal Lake. And I want to apologize. In the last episode, I constantly called Terry Kaiser Terry Crews.
It's going to keep happening. It's
because those two actors look identical to one another, and you would always confuse them, even if they were standing in front of you. And over at the party cabin, at which part is the snobs and which part is the slobs of this? They seem to be intermingled.
Yeah, I said this in the last episode, but none of these people seem to like each other.
At least here it's explained that they're all satellites of Nick's cousin, who died in the last episode. So they haven't necessarily met. They're not in each other's circle. He's the thing that they all rotate around, and they've all agreed to go to this cabin because of him. So at least they explained it this time, as opposed to part three, where you're like, none of these people would ever hang out with one another, ever. And it's just the fact that one of them happens to have a party van. They're like, well, I'll get in that party van. Sure. I don't care.
You would think after like day two and he doesn't show up, maybe a couple of them might decide to start packing it in and going home. I mean, I'm not a particularly sociable person. I would think that if I was stuck in a cabin with people I didn't know and really didn't care for very much, waiting on somebody who has not appeared and has not called anyone, and apparently, to one hilarious joke, might be in jail for drunk driving.
That's what this person's known for.
Yeah, I'd be like, well, you know what? I'm going to go home. If he shows up, give me a call. I'll come back.
I agree with you. The only thing keeping these people in the house is they like loose vegetables. Whether it's sitting on a countertop on top of an uncooked pizza or sitting on top of an unlit barbecue. They love loose vegetables. Or they're super into slice.
Well, that was the drink of 1987?
Oh, yeah. Everyone was drinking slice. Everywhere you went, the hoyest of the polloi had a slice in their hand.
Only the losers drank squirt.
Drinking a squirt, are you? Nerd. So let's start with Nick. He is a very sensible and sensitive piece of hunky man meat.
Yeah, he's pretty dreamy.
He is. Listen, I would not kick him out. I would not kick him out just because he is dressed in all blue at one point. All blue. Like he's auditioning for the Canadian version of the Blue Man Group.
Well, Melissa, I know we'll spend a lot of time on Melissa, but Melissa seems to believe in the whole like solid color ensemble.
Oh, she does. She is a big believer in a uni-look. Yeah,
She's got these like Avon saleswoman pantsuits on. It's really, again, and this is a problem with a lot of these movies, is I don't know how old these characters are supposed to be.
No.
Because Tina, I guess, is supposed to be 18. But
one assumes based on the circumstances. We can pick up from context clues that we assume she's about 18.
I mean, some of these, Melissa carries herself and dresses like she's someone in her 30s. So, you know, again, I mean, I realize these people don't really know each other, but, you know, a 30-year-old isn't going to be going out and partying with an 18-year-old, or at least they should not.
Under normal circumstances, yes. But Melissa is mystifying in a lot of different ways. She's mean girl. Like, she came, you know, fully formed, and they opened up the package, they pressed the on button, and she's like, who do I intimidate around here? Everyone? Okay. Who can I use as a minion for my evil plans? This dipshit over here? Fine. I don't care. That dipshit, by the way, is named Eddie. Eddie is a sci-fi geek whose elevator pitch for his new story contains the following phrase. We follow the last surviving man and his woman. Fuck you, Eddie.
Yeah, I related to Eddie for a couple of minutes, and then I was like, oh, no, he's really fucking annoying. And then I'm like, oh, God, am I like that? Because I can totally see myself, like, covering myself in party streamers and pretending to be the mummy. That is absolutely something I would do. But then I'm like, oh, wait, no, this is like the guy who speaks in nothing but Monty Python quotes.
Pretty much, if they could afford to pay for Monty Python quotes, that might have happened. He's in a long line of... We need a representative of our audience in this movie so that we can make fun of them. Because they only, like, you know, pay for the movie and shit. They're your biggest fans. Make sure to poke them in the eye and punch them in the balls. It's great. By the way, his woman has a name, Eddie. It's Starbabe. Learn it. Then we meet another in a long line of shitty stoner characters. This time, his name is David, and he is laboring under the belief that he's kind of a Buddy Griffith from Just One of the Guys, when in reality, he's just sort of gross and eats olives off the top of uncooked pizzas. Next, we have Maddie. She's eternally saddled with quote-unquote best friend status, and unbeknownst to everyone in the movie, she's part of a secret ZZ Top Transform That Girl video. They just don't know it yet.
She kind of is. Yes.
She gets the legs treatment at one point in this movie. She gives it to herself. She self ZZ Tops.
She doesn't even need that little magic key ring.
I sincerely hope there's someone who's like, you know, I've heard of ZZ Top, but I have no idea what he's talking about. Look up a ZZ Top music video, and you're like, this was entertainment? Yes, that's what I masturbated to. I'm sorry, that's what I watched on MTV back in the day.
This is the episode where things really start to take an interesting turn.
I'm just so relieved to find out someone else is into those beards.
I don't know, man. I just want to curl up in them. And there's something about a guy who's good with his hands, but also is so frivolous with it, he'll just spin it around. I don't know. I like that they like classic cars.
Right?
Yeah. And I don't want to see anyone's eyes, especially not during lovemaking. So the shades help.
I always imagine myself as that third dude from ZZ Top without the beard, because I was like, I can point to stuff.
But the irony is that his last name is Beard.
Yes, right, exactly.
There's so much forethought into ZZ Top. And almost no one talks. They are a relic of a lost time. No one is delving deep into ZZ Top. Unless you're listening to a Friday the 13th podcast.
This has been the ZZ Top cast. Next week, we're going to spend an hour talking about Tube Steak Boogie. Just how disgusting that phrase is.
Oh, God.
That was the original title for Friday the 13th, part 5.
A more apt name. In fact, if it was called Tube Steak Boogie, I'd be easier on it because it would be living up to its potential.
Or living down.
Oh my God, I've lost my place. There's so many characters. People in this movie. We're not even halfway through this list. Okay, now we have Maddie's frenemy, and that's Robin. She's played by Elizabeth Caton. Or Catan? Caton? I don't know how to pronounce her last name. Here's what I know Elizabeth from. She's recognizable to anybody who watched USA Up All Night. Mm-hmm. Because she
recognize the name. I saw the name. I'm like, I know that name.
Yeah, she's that girl in a bikini that I never actually get to see naked, but I'm pretty sure is naked in this movie, in every movie they ever showed. Spoiler alert, she's totes naked in that movie. You just have to watch the unedited version. Look up Vice Academy. She's practically naked in every single one of those. Not that's a bad thing. She's actually funny in those movies. I mean, there's like 4 or 5 laughs in 90 minutes, but, you know, she gets naked and she's funny. Good for her. So beyond her, of course, we have Melissa. And she is the owner of one pair of daddy's pearls. She has received a pair of pearls from her father. She wears around her neck, which is not sexual. At all, I don't know what you're talking about, and that's not weird.
Wait, if we're bringing this back, aren't we bringing this back around to ZZ Top?
Yeah, right?
I do believe they did have a song called Pearl Necklace.
They sure did.
Again, absolutely repulsive in every possible way.
Now, there's a couple other people who show up here. We haven't actually even met them. These are just the people that Tina meets as she enters the house for this party. Which is, I wouldn't say it's a super good time. I mean...
Because you've got Russell, who I guess it's his uncle's house? Is that...
Yes.
Okay, and they're eating his uncle's food. Well, where is his uncle?
That is yet to be determined. No one talks about where his uncle is. I completely forgot Sandra and Russell, who will... I guess the reason why is because we're covering them in this episode, but... If you wanted to know what I looked like in high school, just view Russell. I am Russell, probably 15 pounds lighter only because I could not keep weight on me, something I was able to overcome very quickly.
So you were a poor man's Patrick Dempsey?
Yes. Yeah, I had high hair.
And you wore your pants up to your nipples?
Yes, 1,000%. Every outfit that he wears, he might have stolen from my closet. I pink and bright blue, bluish greens.
So yeah,
I was bathed in them.
Yeah, those Easter egg colors.
Mm-hmm. 100%. I had a lot of braided belts.
Yeah, the cardigan thrown over the shoulder just so.
Yes. I had long sleeve polos that looked like they might be a velour of some kind. Yes.
And how hard did you work to get the Delta House expelled from the college?
Very, very hard at the time. In fact, I did not work very hard at almost anything. I stopped at earning that Eagle Scout. Once I got the Eagle Scout thing, I stopped working hard at almost everything in life.
All downhill from here, baby. I've peaked.
It's sad to think, but it might be true. And his girlfriend, Sandra, who I think might be the person I like the most in the movie.
How can you like her? She's there. She's in it for about 5 minutes.
But those are the best 5 minutes.
I suspect that this has something to do with the outfit she's wearing shortly before her untimely demise. In which she is dressed for reasons I cannot determine, like a hee-haw honey.
I thought it might be a pseudo gator bait cosplay.
That's the same thing, really.
Every Blockbuster video I ever worked at had a copy of Gator Bait, and I was fascinated with it. But for some reason, I refused to pick it up for the longest period of time, just because I knew it would not be as satisfying as the cover would allude it to be, because that's a great VHS cover. It's just a girl in a tree with micro shorts. But I knew, like, probably 100 minutes of that, those shorts would show up in about 3. So I never really gave it a good college try, but boy, Gator Bait.
Gator Bait is great, and I could watch Claudia Jennings just work at a Blockbuster for 90 minutes, and I would be satisfied. So you should someday give Gator Bait a chance.
I will make a resolution to give Gator Bait a try. I also like Sandra for her outfit in that first party scene. She's dressed up like his corporate wife. She's wearing an asymmetrical dynasty thing with a thick, chunky belt. It's almost as if she's a hostess at a nouveau riche Japanese restaurant.
I think that we determined that part 6 had the most baffling aesthetic choices, but I gotta go with this one. There was some outfit selections that I just could not make heads or tails of.
There's so many patches on so many different people.
There's a lot of patches, a lot of pastel, a lot of shirts that are cut in a way that doesn't make sense.
There's so many needless hair waves happening.
Oh yeah, there's some intriguing hairstyles, let's say, and that's only in the men. I mean, literally, yeah. The only way I could tell the male characters apart was from their puzzling hairstyles.
They're all so weird, and they act in the most inexplicable manner. They just keep walking in and out of that kitchen with no real purpose. I mean, why does the stoner kid come back in there just to pop a shotgun of beer and throw it up on everybody, other than the script told him he had to do it?
I just feel like, you know, they're being set up for the audience to you know, be happy when they're killed, and you know, I'm playing right into it. I don't care for these characters. I would not want to be stuck in a cabin out in the middle of nowhere with them.
As long as we're talking about inexplicable things, Russell says something while they're all piled into that tiny, tiny kitchen. Which contains a lot of loose, uncooked food, cans of slice. He says the following: "It looks like closing time at the stock exchange around here. What stock exchange has that many open cans of slice?"
I think that he meant to say, or the screenwriter meant him to say, it looks like Grand Central Station.
Yes.
But even then, it's like, I've been through Grand Central Station a couple of times. There's not a plethora of slice to be found there.
Like, because New Yorkers are too good for slice. You have to go south. Oh my god. Maddie's outfit is crazy. She looks like she's some sort of Beverly Hills Girl Scout. There's so many patches, odd chunky jewelry, and then her belt has like four, it's like a bandolero. The only thing missing from it is bullets.
Yeah, she's kind of got that, like, David Lee Roth, Steven Tyler, too many accessories thing going on.
That's right. She's got bangles. She's where, got everything.
You know, she could be raptured and you wouldn't actually know it because there's just so much fabric and accessories that she could just be like a pile on a couch and you wouldn't actually realize she wasn't there for maybe a half hour or so.
Yeah. I mean, everyone's wearing so many clothes. So many clothes.
Because it's cold. It's cold in July in New Jersey. It's very, very cold.
It's cold snaps in July.
We're still literally not even halfway through the characters, I don't think.
Well, we're going to talk about, I mean, we got through, I mean, we talked in background.
I've already forgotten their names.
If I didn't have notes, this would be impossible. Nick walks into that kitchen to introduce Tina to the group, and he does so like he's been told that he's Pinocchio and his strings were just cut off screen as he walks in. I don't know how arms and legs work. He introduces her, and then Melissa sidles in like she's a snake woman. I'm not entirely sure what her character is other than Mean Girl. Because if she wants to just have sex with Nick, I think it would have happened already, right?
Yeah, I mean, she's just shooting daggers at Tina from go. I mean, even in the earlier scene when Tina is just, you know, has the audacity to unpack, you know, remove a suitcase from a trunk, she's just sneering and making comments and you know, really being set up as this, you know, broadly hateful character. And I mean, I don't know. Has there been any other characters so far in the series in which it was just designed to be so, you know, blatantly terrible?
That's certainly not in the first four. I mean, everyone is blatantly horrible in part five.
Well, that's, yeah, but I mean, like, to the point where it's like, why is this person even here? Why are these people tolerating and making excuses? And again, that lends itself to, do these people know each other or do they not know each other? Because, you know, they act like they're there together for the first time, and yet every time Melissa does something incredibly bitchy, everybody's like, oh, well, she's just like that. Well, I mean, haven't you just met her? Because, you know, and if you haven't just met her, then why are you still spending time with her? Because she's clearly a terrible person who does not like her friends.
A, I don't think they're her friends. B, I think there could be a couple of explanations. One, she comes with a set of instructions where everyone goes, oh, she's a designated, I'm going to hate everybody person. Okay, I'll operate under that knowledge. Or her legend precedes her, where they heard tale of a blonde wedge attached to a devil woman. And, you know, everyone knows that legend, but no one's ever heard of the mountain of dead bodies that they're all partying on top of.
My theory with Melissa is this. She's actually the latter half of a body swap comedy that we did not see. So there's a 50-year-old adult woman trapped inside her body, which explains why she dresses the way she does, why she has so much disdain for her fellow young people. And then somewhere off screen is an actual 50-year-old woman who wants to party and have sex and isn't being murdered by Jason. There's just no other explanation for it.
Yeah, they could have.
This detention situation that you've.
Yeah, I mean, this would have been around the same time that there was like a plethora of body swap movies. Like,
right.
There was the one with Kirk Cameron. There was one with Fred Savage and Judge Reinhold.
Vice Versa.
Yes, yes. There was, you know, well, this was in between the original Freaky Friday and then the remake. But yeah, maybe this was, you know, they were trying to shove in another genre movie in there, but. But yeah, she definitely comes off the sort of Sweet Valley High kind of villainous character, and it really sort of just is very, very clumsily inserted into this, you know, this slasher movie. It's like, wait, who's the real villain here? Are we getting into some sort of like The Walking Dead? You know, it's the people, it's the humans that are the real monsters here.
Where was all of these very mad geeks when? Dudes took over the Freaky Friday. It's okay if dudes sort of suddenly swap bodies between child and adult, but when you make a lady Doctor Who, everyone's like, oh, my eyes will never be recovered from this child's show that I'm still attached to.
Yeah, as long as you're giving things to fanboys and not taking them away, they are satisfied. Which, of course, suggests that you're taking something away by making a Ghostbuster or a Doctor Who a woman, which you are not, but that is, I think, the mentality.
Now, all previous copies of Doctor Who are going to be burned. They're going to be burned and then not put out with male tears. Oh, it's just, gosh. It's going to be a bonfire forever at the center of Trafalgar Square.
And then everybody's going to have to be zapped with one of those things from the Men in Black movies where it wipes your memories.
Yeah. Well, that's what happened with Ghostbusters. We never, there was another Ghostbusters, every child says.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
So now that we've taken down the male rights industrial complex, take that, doofus, with a Twitter account, which would count for me. I'm a doofus with a Twitter account. The only other question I really have during the sequence, other than Tina having now, she can both have telekinesis and second sight. She's getting a Eyes of Laura Mars situation where she's being flashed into Jason's murder spree.
Yeah, they're definitely starting to mix their kind of abilities here.
Now we got a giallo on her hands. I'm psychically linked to Jason. All I want to do is perv on people through windows and make traps and decorate with dead bodies. The only other sitch that I got to talk about in this is randomly when Tina runs out the door, the back door, there's a bra and panty set mismatched, nailed to the door.
I don't think I noticed that.
I don't think I did either.
Yep. It really happens. They are not part of a matching set. They're just rando. After she drops her coke on the ground, she runs out, and hanging next to balloons is the panties, and on top of a calendar is the bra.
So yeah, this is turning into like a frat house sitch, isn't it?
Yeah. Like all of a sudden Up the Creek is breaking out in the middle of this.
Yeah, they really are trying to throw a lot of things at the wall in this, aren't they?
It's almost as if this is a formula they don't trust and they want to keep adding things just to see what will work and what won't. Tina then reports back to Mom that she's seen a man thing murdering somebody in someone else's kitchen.
And that he left the spike, that the tent spike, and like lodged into the wall outside their house.
Yes. Jason managed to clean it for some fucking reason. Because that's what mutant zombies who've been living in a lake for God knows how long will do. Like, let me clean this up.
Do you think he keeps a hanky in his pocket, or do you think he just does the whole wiping it on like his pants leg?
I think pants leg. Don't you think he's a pants leg sort of guy?
Yeah, I think he kind of, you know, he has good time management, and while he's just stalking through the woods, he's just wiping this thing off on his leg.
I'm going to clean this up and leave it for her as a thank you.
Plus, he has to anticipate that sooner or later he's going to be back in that lake, and it's just going to wash off.
That's right.
Because at least once a movie, he's in a lake.
Well, that's the thing, Patrick. Okay, I'm going to ask you, and I'll keep asking people. This is a character that supposedly drowned, right. Couldn't fucking swim.
Right.
Starting in part 4, all of a sudden, he's Mark goddamn Spitz. Where he could just get in water and shoot out at people.
Yeah,
In the last movie, he kept kicking like he was a fucking water polo player to keep his torso above water. I mean, where did he learn all this shit?
Probably when he learned how to drive in part 2. He went to the same school for psychotic killers as for them to learn practical skills as Michael Myers did when he learned how to drive.
Yeah, where are these training programs now, Trump?
I mean, it may just be the situation where, you know, he drowned as a kid, and then when he came back to life, he was like, "Well, I am not doing that again," and quickly enrolled at the YMCA, and you know, took a couple classes, learned how to.
This is probably
swim.
On his on his journey with his mom's head in a bag that he took at the beginning of part two.
Just picturing just Jason laying out in the pool with like a bunch of little small children, kind of learning, you know, someone, we teach a child how to swim, you put your hand on their stomach and they start kicking around and then you slowly take the hand and they start moving or they sink like a stone. It's adorable. Imagine Jason trying to do that.
All of the other kids were willing to put their heads underwater before Jason, and the teacher had to keep. Come on, just down, just up to your nose, Jason. Yeah. Just up to your nose.
I'll give you these.
Get
I have
the bag
I have,
wet. It's fine.
I have M&Ms. If you do it, I'll give you some M&Ms. He really loves M&Ms. It turned out to work.
I'm just not that strong a swimmer. He grunts to himself because he can't really talk. This has been what Jason Voorhees would be like at a YMCA kids swimming place. Come see us next Saturday. We'll have a whole new show based on your suggestions. Oh my God. The level of horseshit going on at the family side of camp is crazy. I will give Lar Park Lincoln and Terry Kaiser this. They are trying. They're triers, right? They're giving it their all.
Yeah, I mean, if I could understand Dr. Cruz's motivations, other than he has the bad guy written on his forehead in you know, eyeliner pencil. So, you know, when he's screaming at this girl, I'm like, I'm questioning your credentials, sir. So I'm not sure there's any sort of, you know, any sort of psychiatric treatment that involves your doctor screaming at you and bullying you into staying in an isolated cabin where your father violently died in front of you many years earlier.
Again, it's like he went to some sort of medical school where the only way they were taught to heal was to yell at somebody like they've drowned and you're trying to yell them into living again. All of the abyss. Meanwhile, you have Susan Blue playing Tina's mom. And she is primarily a voice actress. And so every once in a while, you catch her when everyone else is talking, just waiting for her turn to talk.
Yeah, and then she I think that her her entire direction in this script is you know, she frets.
Yeah.
She's very fretful.
She's a fret machine.
She frets a lot.
Yeah.
She fretfully.
She's the fret-o-matic.
You know, says fretfully. Fretfully stares.
When they're outside examining where the spike was, and Dr. Bad News Cruz is giving his explanation that these things are just manifestations of her guilt. Susan Blue is looking at him and mouths his lines like she learned everyone's lines and is just waiting for her turn to say hers. And no one thought when they were looking at this through the camera or at Video Village, and who knows when this happened, but no one saw it in dailies and was like, we should probably get another take on that.
It's sort of like when you, if you ever did a drama in high school or college, you've got if you were ever a stage manager, you kind of had to learn everybody's lines so you could remember certain lighting cues and sound cues. And if you ever had a person drop out and had to go into their role, sometimes you would be reciting everybody else's dialogue in your head. You're not supposed to be mouthing their dialogue at them while they're saying it.
Well, no one told her that, including the director or any of the gaffers or the editor back in Paramount Studios. Nothing. They just let that go by. She has a unique voice. I'll give her that. She's great for portraying squirrels. Kill, 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 kill. Break, 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 break. Hey there, hi there, ho there, killers. It's your old pal, Patrick Hamilton. I'm breaking in here because if you rate and review us on iTunes and you tell us what your favorite kill is in the Friday the 13th series, we read it here on the air. That's our solemn promise to you, the listener. And so that's what I'm doing right now. We're going to start off with Romana D.W., and she gives pays us some very nice compliments, but she also mentions that her favorite kill from part 7 is when Jason picks up a girl in a sleeping bag and bashes her against the tree. That's what we're talking about in this episode. Also, our friend AmyFix66 here on iTunes, but she talks to us all the time on Twitter, and if you are on Twitter, why not do the same? Join the conversation. She also loves that kill, so this would be a great addition for her as well, and we thank her for doing us a solid on iTunes. In addition, a couple other people who gave us great reviews, Kafka Squire, RJ47890, Divisive Issues, and the Film Roast Podcast. And if you haven't checked out Divisive Issues or Film Roast, you can find them on iTunes. And hey, give them a nice review. Let's spread the love, people. And so that is all for this particular week. We thank you all for joining in and helping spread the joy of Kill by Kill. If you haven't already given us a review on iTunes, I implore you to do so, so that we can share this with more and more people. And so, right now, the body count continues. Kill, 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 kill. Break, 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 break. So, we turn from this now, smash cut, to two people we've never met before.
Just chilling. Just I don't think the character's name, the female character's name, was ever spoken. And again,
she's Judy.
I've already forgotten.
Judy and Dan.
They're cold. Judy, we know they're cold.
Judy's cold. Dan would like to have sex, and he's got a bad Arnold Schwarzenegger impression.
I will say that, for as annoyed as I was at I'll Be Back, this is just a few years removed from the Terminator, so it's actually not as overplayed at that time as it would be today. But also, it felt like such a relief to hear one of the characters in a Friday the 13th movie reference a movie that was more or less current, because for whatever reason, especially in parts 1 and 2, all of their references are weird old like 30s movies or old vaudeville routines. They're all just like, see, like, why are they, is this all they watch? Are they well steeped in the classics? I was like, well, at least this guy's seen the Terminator.
Every character there has been raised on a steady diet of Turner classic movies.
Yes, it's the weirdest thing.
Or where they go in part 4 where they're dancing to like their grandpa's ballroom dancing music.
Yeah, all of them have, I think at the time we sort of surmised that maybe they had Bugs Bunny syndrome, where they only knew these references because Bugs Bunny had imitated them in his cartoons.
Yeah, yeah.
Or, yeah, it's just, what you can say for it is, like, there was a sort of a vibe, especially that first one, where they gathered everyone from the New York theater scene. And so, they're like, what do you do? And it's like, well, I've got a killer Betty Davis impression. All right, well, why don't you do it in the middle of this abandoned bathroom to yourself in a mirror? Okay. That'll take up time before we put this hatchet in your face. Will do, boss.
There just didn't seem to be a lot of young people working on this franchise, aside from the actors. And so I feel like all the decisions made behind the scenes are like old man decisions. And yes. So I don't know.
No, I think you've completely nailed it, Patrick, because a lot of this, and the sort of thing that is fun about it, is it has a lot of anachronistic touches, because they're definite slices of time. There are very few franchises that came out one after the other, after the other, after the other. They, with the exception of 3D, they had that 2-year skip. Everything else is right after one another. So they're very much commenting on the time, or what some Paramount executive thinks kids are into,
right,
at the time, or some, you know, would-be screenwriter from Pittsburgh thinks of teenagers at the time. Well, the other thing is, these aren't really teenagers, they're all supposed to be young adults for the most part, which puts them in a different sphere than A Nightmare on Elm Street, where, right, they really are supposed to be teenagers, and so they took even weirder risks with them. We skip off to the wilderness, and these two, who I have to believe were originally supposed to be the characters we discussed in the last episode, Michael and his girlfriend, because they say, why don't we just camp here? And then she talks them out of it, because they need to get to this party. And then a little bit later, they're like, well, we need to murder some more people. Well, why don't we just use that campaign sequence that we wrote and write it for somebody else? You okay?
Solid. Run with it.
Right. Yeah. We already bought the tent and sleeping bag. Let's do this shit. And we need somebody to introduce a machete into this.
Yeah. Is this the like fourth or fifth machete he's just sort of randomly found?
Yeah. Why doesn't he keep his machetes closer to the vest? There was one at the bottom of that fucking lake.
Who knew that the machete industry was so fruitful in 1980s New Jersey? I never saw a piece of that. I never knew a single person that owned a machete.
There's a lot of bushwhacking out in New Jersey, from what I can understand.
You would think that we would be given a machete as a fifth birthday gift. It's time to find your way out of these dark and dangerous woods by yourself, my children.
See, that's just what Big Machete wants you to think, man.
The only way to stop a backwoods mutant with a machete is to have a machete yourself.
I never earned my machete chopping badge in Girl Scouts. It's literally just a patch with a machete and a disembodied hand.
Because that's primarily what happens to people with machetes in these movies in this locale. So, yeah, they have this tete-a-tete that's straight out of His Girl Friday. Once again, Friday the 13th wants to think itself
His Girl Friday the 13th. The screwball comedy Friday.
I love how natural and realistic she sounds. She says, "Hey, you big honk, come and get me." That's my favorite line reading in the entire movie. It's a shame that it's expended on the first 25 minutes of the movie or so.
They have alternating accents where one of them picks up a sort of southern accent and then drops it, and the other one uses it for a little while.
They're workshopping.
They're both hot and cold. They're a Katy Perry song 20 years ahead of its time. She convinces him to go get more wood and then immediately runs into the tent and starts taking off of all of her clothes. Have their sex games gotten too elaborate to steal something from Dan McCoy?
You know, all these characters always seem to have some sort of, I don't want you to see me get undressed, so go do this thing. And end up getting brutally murdered. I'll be over here taking my clothes off and then laying in bed coyly waiting for you.
Yeah, you could just have sex. You know what would warm you up? Having sex.
Just getting
cut
in
out
that,
the middleman.
Just getting in that sleeping bag. You don't even have to take off all your clothes.
No, you don't have to do that for me. You're already in a sleeping bag. Just mash your productive organs up against one another. I'm not sure how it works. I haven't seen it before. A kid showed up here at one point. I don't know how it happened. But from what I read in Penthouse Forum, there's like a, it's like an interlock. Have you guys ever used a mechanical press?
No, but I have put together IKEA furniture. I understand it's the same process.
Okay, there we go. Finally, something everyone can understand. It's the failure to understand sex and the failure to build IKEA furniture. Perfect. So yeah, she sends him off. He starts hacking at wood with a machete while she undresses and takes off her high top white tennis shoes because it's 1987 and that's what everyone gets, myself included. So yeah, Dan goes off and he gets the old Jason Voorhees reverse chest burster and neck snapping combo.
Yeah, that seems a little overkill.
It's like putting a hat on top of a hat.
Yes. Literally. This is like a combo death from part six. This is one of those, throughout part six, there are a lot of deaths where Jason Voorhees would go, I can do that now?
Yeah, he's basically playing Mortal Kombat at this point.
Yes, I think he is playing Mortal Kombat. And very Mortal Kombat for Dan, R.I.P.D.
Every move is a finish him.
And then he teleports back to the campfire, and Judy notices his very unkempt pants as he wanders around a campfire.
His pants are shredded.
Terrible pants. Those were perfectly fine pants, and he rose from the grave in them. And for some reason, just, you know, being in the water all that time has made the hem go all to shit.
He's gonna take that work suit back to Sears and try to get a deal on that lifetime guarantee.
That's right. Now, once again, what Sears is he gonna go to, and how do you think that's gonna happen? Because he doesn't have a receipt, and if he did, it's probably all wet by now.
I think really he just needs to kind of raise the machete in a slightly threatening manner, and they'll just bring out a new pantsuit. I mean, these pantsuits are probably made overseas. It probably costs about 30 cents a pantsuit. there are small children in a factory somewhere making these pantsuits.
Like, why do we have to make so many of them? Because Jason Voorhees is a one-man industry.
He so rarely reuses a weapon, though, which is a bizarre trope of this franchise, where, like, he has a perfectly good tent spike. He discards it so that he can find something else. So I feel like if he's going into Sears... because we're still on this premise, he's not bringing the machete. He's got to work with what he's got. So I see, you know, those little the little paper tickets where you take a number and then sometimes there'll be like a spike on the counter where you then put the number when you're done with it. I'm thinking he picks up the spike.
It just raises that in a threatening manner.
Yeah.
I could see that, or maybe a, you know, greeting card rack. He just starts to pitch it at someone's head, or. Maybe an industrial vacuum cleaner. Mm-hmm.
I like this greeting card rack one because I feel like he could smash a person with it and then a clever director will cut to the corpse of that person and the cards covering them will all be like, sorry for your loss cards. They'll all be bereavement cards. And that's right out of part six.
Bromley, are you secretly MC Hammer? Because you fucking nailed it. So Judy is waiting for her Arnold Schwarzenegger impression machine of a man to come back. And then Jason, he pulls apart four. He rips into that tent with a machete, then abandons that weapon. It's like, well, fuck it. I need to stretch. I need the kind of workout that's hip for today. What are the kids doing? They're cross training. They're using tires and ropes. So he picks up that fucking sleeping bag and bashes her inside against a tree.
I kind of love this one because it reminds me of one of my favorite ridiculous death scenes, which is from a movie called Prophecy.
The bear one or the angel one?
The bear one.
Okay.
The mutant bear creature. There is a wonderful scene, which is it is hilariously implausible. In which this bear creature, who was mutated because of toxic waste or some sort of very very timely environmental issue, attacks a campground, and one of the characters attempts to hop away in their sleeping bag, which is a very efficient means of escape, and the bear creature just basically backhands this person, the sleeping bag, and he does this like barrel roll into like a rock wall and literally explodes. And it is the best thing I've ever seen. I could watch that YouTube clip over and over and over again because all I can think is how fucking hard did this bear creature hit this person in the sleeping bag that he flips over and over and over and then just erupts in a shower of feathers and sleeping bag scraps.
This is a top 10 death for me as far as the Friday the 13th franchise. It probably would have been a lot better in its unedited form, which upon telling was that he bashed the sleeping bag against the tree 3 or 5 times. That would have been even better, but there's something primal about it that's so ridiculous that he was just using someone inside of something that they felt safe in and smashing them up against the tree.
Just treating them like a sack of potatoes.
Yeah. Just working it out. Free weighting it. You know, this is what the ideal male body is. And some people may not like it, but it's the truth.
I actually like, you know, this movie unfortunately was hacked to pieces. And I think really suffers because of it. I don't. It's one of my least favorite of the Friday movies, and perhaps with some of the gore intact, it might go up a notch or two. But the sleeping bag death is actually, I agree, it's one of the best in the entire series. It may even be the best, but I actually like it with just the one hit. I think the mistake is then when they cut back to her and she just has like a little bit of blood on her head or whatever. I'd almost rather just imagine what's going on in that sleeping bag. But yeah, there's something about just the one and done that makes it funny to me. I don't know. I mean, that's probably the wrong attitude to take, right? But
no, it is funny because it's just a silly way for someone to be killed. I mean, it's brutal and yet silly at the same time.
Yeah, it's like it's so surprising, and at the same time, you're just like, well, yeah, of course, that's what you would do. He's not using a weapon, and usually when he's not using a weapon, it's like he loves throwing people out windows, you know, or smashing their faces in the shower or something. But this one is one of the few, you know, just his hands deaths that I think really works.
It's a Jackie Chan sort of thing where he's just using the environment around him, and you're like, oh, that's so clever.
And then just during the credits, stuff. They show the bloopers where he threw his back out, slamming the sleeping bag into the tree.
I like it a lot. So then it's the next goddamn day,
and they're still partying. They're determined to keep having this party with no sign or word from the guest of honor.
No, and we're introduced to two more people who weren't there before. Oh my god, they showed up late. And yeah, it's Ben and Kate, not the late Fox show that was much funnier than anyone gave it the time of day for. That was one of the best Fox pilots I ever came across. This is a very unfunny Ben and Kate, and they have a personal problem with one another that to date has not arisen. No one says it out loud. Everyone just has to suffer with how shitty they are to one another. Then we cut to Nick and Tina, and Nick has Friday the 13th disease here. He's forgotten how to do something. That's skip stones. He's just throwing rocks into a body of water. That's not fun. No one just throws giant rocks into the water unless you're five. Then that's fine. But not people who have to attend night school. They are either attempting to skip rocks or actually skipping rocks. So he gives this is their we're both damaged moment where they're going to. They're going to talk about what makes them at the moment and how that brings them together. Nick was running with the bad crowd in Pittsburgh. We've all done that. And Tina killed her dad. That makes them perfect for one another. So it starts with, this is where my dad died. My dad died right over there. I'm pretty sure I was involved in it. I pretty much killed my dad.
and Nick's face is just like completely impassive. He's like, yeah, that happens.
This is a real I know who killed me moment where people get cut. They just accept the worst violence they've ever heard of. Like my finger falls off. Yeah, people get cut. I killed my dad. People die. People die near lakes all the time. I've killed like three or four people in lakes. That's what we have in common.
He's trying to score. He'll put up with anything. He's like, it's cool. Listen, we all have baggage. I get it.
And in the meantime, Melissa is sneaking up on them like a teal ninja in cowboy boots. She's like a fucking Power Ranger.
Yeah, that scene is cut very weird. I feel like that there was supposed to be more that happened in that scene, and she's just very clumsily listening in on their conversation.
I think that's what the subtitle of the movie should be. Friday the 13th, Part 7, I feel something more should have happened. And this is a movie I like, people. At this point, it's a sort of bachelor hometown visit sitch where the sins of the past have come to a root, but the person is so hot and heavy for them, they don't care anymore. They're like, I don't care that your parents are super weird and you're part of a cult and they may have killed your dad on a lake and that you have telekinesis and that you can see murders that may or may not have happened. You know, I want to see what's doing underneath those high-waist jeans, y'all. So then we go back to our snobs versus slobs cabin. And our stoner is going to get everyone high as a kite. And he announces this by yelling all aboard the Columbian Express. Why doesn't anyone in the Friday the 13th universe understand that Columbia is cocaine?
Yeah, I was like, is he going to put out some lines here? Because
no, everyone's going to smoke. There's no cocaine scene. Cocaine is an exclusive Part 5 deal. No one else knows where that dude's dealer is.
This had to have been written by the same. This had to have been written by the same person who wrote the you know, it looks like the New York Stock Exchange. It's like just getting these lines like almost right, and then just suddenly zagging off to the left somewhere.
One afternoon, he half watched an after-school special. He's like, I got it. I know how the kids talk.
I mean, there are some of these lines in this movie are like, you know, one step away from you know, the airplane. You know, I guess the foot is on the other. I guess the shoe is on the other hand now.
So Melissa conspires with Eddie to really get Tina's goat because obviously she has information now. That's going to utterly destroy Tina. And there's nothing that gets Melissa's juices flowing than ruining someone else. She really wants to make Tina angry because we're giving this the full Carrie treatment. And we get it. Tina starts to squint really hard like she's trying to squeak past an eyesight test at a DMV without her glasses because she doesn't want to wear them in her photo.
And you could almost see the lines on that necklace being pulled as it's like trying to lift away from Melissa's neck.
Yeah. The only thing wonkier telekinesis related than this is when Tina tries, well, she doesn't try. She actually lifts up a television and throws it at Dr. Bad News. And you can see it wobble. Mm-hmm. like a Teamster's just off camera. Like, well, fuck, this is heavier than I thought.
I thought they were going to take out all the parts in the middle in this.
Everyone said you were going to take out the guts of it, and I'm lifting a whole fucking TV.
That was back when even tabletop televisions weighed about 300 pounds.
That's right. Now they were full of heavy fucking equipment.
Now you have a 40-inch television. It weighs about as much as a pack of cigarettes.
It's wafer thin. Because we mentioned Monty Python and someone had to demonstrate that they were that kind of dipshit in high school. I was. I didn't know what humor was, so I needed to borrow someone else's. So, Tina gets the whammy here. Melissa gets the whammy from Tina. We see her dad's pearls get erect and then explode.
You are on a roll, my friend, today.
It's not my fault that the movie gives me this material. I didn't create the movie. I had no part in it. But when I ordered it online, they sent me the Blu-ray, and I can see every part of it now. And so that just that makes Tina go nuts. Then we see Tina go back to her mom, who frets. And Dr. Bad News, she throws a TV at Dr. Cruz. And the entire time, Terry Kaiser is mopping his eye. It's weepy. He's got that Casino Royale, I bleed from my eyes while I play poker disease.
He's looking like he's got a little bit of guyliner going on in this movie. I can't quite figure it out.
Yes. He might have hit himself with a bit of charcoal in the corner, trying to create those perfect bat wings.
When he's not mopping his eye, he's just weirdly, like, folding a handkerchief. Like, he just needs some sort of business. As though he were predicting that someday he would have to do a role that requires him to do nothing but sit on a couch and be dragged around by Jonathan Silverman. So he's like, I gotta work all my business in now. Give me the Kleenex.
This is all going away. Right. Listen, Brad Pitt isn't going to beat me to this. He might be eating several years from now, but I have folding. Folding's my thing.
And yeah, and she throws the TV at him. And no one believes this.
Sure, I believe that you can make matches strike. I think you can move things with your mind. See murder? No, that's too much.
Smash cut to the middle of the night when Sandra and Russell are now night number 3, 4, who knows how long I've been there. And he asks a simple question of her, something everyone asks their partner. When was the first time you knew that you really loved me? And being the, you know, sassy gal that she is, she immediately states that there, what drew her to him was the bulge in his pants made from his wallet. I can believe this. I believe it, because there's no way you could see the bulge of his penis in those pants. They're too voluminous.
And really, he has no other redeeming qualities.
No. It's certainly not that he dresses well or looks good. I can tell you, because I looked exactly like him, and no one was into it.
And he doesn't quite understand metaphors. He complains about how much food everyone is eating. Which, you know, when you're hosting a party, the first thing you do is not bitch about how much food your guests are eating.
All Sandra wants to do is get naked near him and fuck. And he's like, ah, what about my uncle's cabin? Dude! Sandra's right there. Do you think she's going to put up with this shit for long if that's all you complain about constantly? Like, think. Think, dude. No. No. She, as all the best instincts, she sees a body of water. She's like, I got to take off this barely any clothes that I'm wearing. I got to get into that cold ass lake. And he's like, I'll be right there. I just have 50,000 items of clothes to take off.
He really does. He's got like a sweater, a shirt. You know, I'm surprised he doesn't have, you know, an Ocean Pacific t-shirt underneath that that plaid Easter basket shirt.
No, he probably has 3 pairs of underwear on, 2 pairs of socks, a scarf that he just ties around his midsection to make him semi-eunuch.
I'm sad we never got to see him stripped down to the t-shirt that says, "What about my uncle's cabin?" Ask me about my uncle's cabin would probably be funnier. I kind of screwed that up, so oh well.
It works either way. I'm really fine with it. It's a great, we're going to steal that, just like we stole Get Bunked from our guests. We steal all our best material from our guests that will, once you say it on the program, we own it. Copyright, Kill by Kill. So look for that t-shirt coming soon. So yeah, she hops in the drink, and he begins to the laborious process of taking all of those clothes off. In the meantime, Jason's like, well, people are getting naked. Bling, 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 bling. Guess who shows up to ruin the party? And he gives Russell a good old hatchet axe machete to the face. I have the Blu-ray of it. I still can't fucking see what instrument he's using to slice open his face. But he gives it that sort of golf swing action. I don't think we've seen that before, where he's like, it's like pitching in softball.
Yeah, he's got a little flair going on with that.
Yeah, he's feeling his oats.
Yeah, the wiki says that it is an axe.
Yeah, the wiki also states that people are buried with one another if they were sleeping with one another.
I am really disappointed by how in the later movies the whoever maintains these wikis did not have the care and dedication of mentioning how and where these people were buried.
Yeah, like what is Sandra's parents' names? We don't know, and no one made it up for us to make fun of. Come on, Wikia. You were so good for so long. And then when we really needed you, you're like, I'm tired. I blew it all trying to talk about the scene which a cocaine addict picks up a monologuing waitress.
So, RIPD Russell, you won't be missed, not even by your uncle when he sees the state of that cabin, because it's now littered with bodies and empty slice cans. And so Sandra sees him and his dead body, gore from very far away, and is like, fuck, this is crazy. Then she gets Friday the 13th disease. Her problem is she has forgotten how to swim in a direction. She's just pulling donuts in the same spot. And for some reason, Jason bamfs into the middle of this lake.
He does some sort of like Esther Williams, like leaping out of the water in like a spectacular fountain.
No, he's like fucking Orca, this guy. This person who drowned and then didn't. Who's supposed to be like that? That should be the one thing that he can't fucking do. But no, we broke that rule. Now that he's been living in water, I guess like he can control it like he's fucking Aquaman. Like he's signaling eels to hold him up. Whatever, you know, sea life he's communicating with under the water. And then just we get a shot from underneath because we have to make sure if we paid Sandra to see her naked, that we'll get to see her naked both dry and wet. And then we get a Jaws homage, and she disappears into the drink. RIPD, Sandra. You'll be missed. I love you. At least teenage me really loves you. The current me is like, you're a bit young for me. But 1987 me loves you.
Well, and she carries over some, because she had also been in... Heidi Kozak had also been in Slumber Party Massacre 2. She carries over some goodwill for me. So I'm with you. She was probably my favorite.
Yeah, she's a lot of things are great about Slumber Party Massacre. And she's perfect for that. Her attitude really fits in there. Here she's a bit of an outsider, but everyone's an outsider because they've been pulled from the I have one character quirk warehouse. And I mean, it's almost as if they were like, you know, we've seen people get murdered, but we want to see what happens when they're all in the same house and things get real. And then
true
Jason
story.
Arrives.
I mean, they just really need someone to be like noodling on a guitar or right. someone with an Irish accent.
I can't believe you ate all my peanut butter.
Who's you people? Slam cut. Black and white footage of a brick wall.
Everybody hurts.
And this has been the Real World cast, everybody. So that's this section of the movie, and that means that it's game time, people. It's choose your own death adventure. That's where we decide of the deaths that we're presented with in this section of the film. If we had to die in one of those ways, what would we choose and why? And let's review our options here ever so quickly. We can either die by reverse chest burster and neck snap, or we can be bashed against a tree inside of our own sleeping bag. We can get golf sliced in the face with a hatchet or machete or some sort of sharp instrument. Or drown. You could just drown. You could just let the icy cold grip of death take a hold of you. And it's supposed to be calm and peaceful, but it sounds like hell. So those are our options. Patrick, as our guest, I turn to you first.
I gotta go sleeping bag all the way. Not only because it's iconic in the series, but also because I know I'll be warm. I'll be comfortable. In the theatrical cut, at least I'm only getting slammed one time. If we were going like the uncut version, I might change my answer because getting bashed five or six times, probably not as fun, but just one hit against a tree and I'm done. That doesn't seem so bad.
Oh, yeah. Now you will have to don those high tops and probably
way ahead of you.
Okay. Check and check. Gina, what say you?
Well, I would say the sleeping bag, but also I would not want my corpse to be found unclothed. So I am going to have to go with axe to the face. You know, it's quick. I'm mostly clad. I mean, granted, you know, my friends and family will wonder, why was she dressed like that? But, you know, that's probably would lead to more questions. Is why was she naked in a sleeping bag?
Well, because it was cold outside and you were going to warm yourself with your own body heat, and you wearing cold clothes on top of it really doesn't keep you any warmer. At least that's the way my father explained it to me.
Your father said that you should get naked in a sleeping bag.
What? Who said?
Where am I? Does someone smell almonds?
Come back to us, Patrick. Just take a deep breath. Just come back. You're safe. You're here. It's okay.
I don't. Why are we talking about sleeping bags? Anyways, the way I would die, I'm pretty sure would be the axe swing to the face. Because like everything else, I mean, I'm basically Russell, people. I hate to tell you this. I was fucking Russell. It's sad. I was Russell in every way other than the fact that Russell was actually getting laid in 1987. And I was not.
Well, I mean, you were what, 15? I mean, how many 15-year-olds do you know were, you know, out there getting some?
It felt like every other 15-year-old but me felt that way. Probably was not true.
Well, you know, it's the only thing that's worse than you being Russell is basically that I was pretty much Eddie. So, you know, that's debate over. We can have a hearty debate over which one of us had it worse back in the day, as the youths tend to say.
At least Eddie was creative. Like, Russell just complains about shit he can't control.
And his uncle's and his uncle's house.
Yeah. Yeah, my uncle didn't have a house. I'll tell you that right now. Not a house that I had access to that I could invite a bunch of assholes over to ruin. So that pretty much brings us to the end of this edition. But of course, before we go, we want to know where everyone can be found. Patrick, where can people find out more about you and what you're doing in your podcast and whatnot?
Yeah, so the podcast is called F This Movie. We post a show every week. We have reviews and articles and stuff almost every day at fthismovie.net. And I'm also co-hosting a show about horror movies through Daily Dead called Corpse Club, which you can find at dailydead.com. And I'm just regular me on Twitter, just at Patrick Bromley, just my name.
Excellent. Check it out, people. Gina, where can people find you on the internet?
I write about 70s and 80s television at tuneintonight.wordpress.com.
Check it out, people. Do it today. Hey, do you want to talk to us here at the Kill by Kill podcast? There's a couple different ways you can do it. You can reach out on Twitter at Kill by Kill Pod. You want to say something longer than 140 characters? Send us an email. Like, people still do that occasionally. I mean, old people do, not youngins, but still, you know, let's say you have a story to tell. Don't give me one of those threads. Fuck that. Send me an email at killbykillpod@gmail.com. Follow us on Instagram at killbykillpodcast. And you know what would be nice? If you gave us a kind review on iTunes, I'd appreciate it. Everyone asks you, but only I am asking from the deepest, warmest part of my heart. If you tell us what your favorite kill in the Friday the 13th franchise is, we will read it here on the air. That is our solemn promise to you, the listener. And sadly, that is all for today, but the body count will continue next time. For myself, Patrick, Gina, and another Patrick, bye-bye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.
Kill by Kill is produced by We Write Good and is intended for entertainment purposes only. Friday the 13th is owned by Paramount Pictures. Jason is owned by New Line Cinema. No infringement is intended. Kill by Kill logo was designed by Josh Hollis. Visit him at joshhollis.com. The Kill by Kill theme was created exclusively for us by Revenge Body. Get the whole track and much, much more at revengebodymemphis.bandcamp.com today.